My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. Don't know whether to thank Bill or not. He's setting the bar awfully high. I do want to thank Bill, the rest of the committee who put this event on. I want to thank a couple of new friends who met me at the airport. I want to thank Tom and Eric for picking me up and doing what it is we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Standing in the spotlight of Alcoholics Anonymous right now. This is the work that people do that everybody sees. And I remember being new and thinking when I was listening to a guy like I am up here tonight. I remember, and somebody out there is me and is thinking to themselves, man, I know I could do better than that cat up there. Can't wait till they ask me to speak in one of these things. I remember being like that and thinking how, you know, what it must be like, and because that's the kind of guy I am. But I really, you know, I'm grateful. I've had the opportunity to stick around here for a couple of summers. And I'm grateful that I've had the opportunity to go through some summers and some springs and some winters in my own recovery and learn some things about what it really is that we do in these rooms. And one of the things I learned that will stand me in the best stead no matter what. I like when Jules came up here and talked about the challenge. I'm going to talk about that. I wasn't intending to, but I like when he talked about that. But one of the things I know that will work when nothing else works, it's mentioned throughout the book all the time. And it says when all other activities fail, nothing assures immunity from drinking as much as one alcoholic sharing with another. And when those two cats pick me up, you know, it's a lot of stuff that's done. We got a circle and a triangle that's the symbol of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unity, recovery, and service. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy, I fell in love with the fellowship before I fell in love with the program. I really am big on the unity part and meetings and fellowship and, you know. And then the recovery part, when I got a taste, because the way I am, I'm a mad dog in the life. And when I got up in here and I started getting a taste of recovery, I got like that with the book and the process and the steps and this power. And then that third part, that service part, that putting that awakened spirit in the service. Call them the shadow soldiers, the true heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it's cats that's sitting in here right now that do the work in the shadows. I was listening when we did that clip, and I'm so grateful that you started it out like that. You know, with Bud Bill, when the guy that founded this deal that we're here for. You know, toiling in the shadows, and those are the guys that's not the ones that's standing up in here in front of everybody right now. They're the ones who go and drive in the rain, and they pick up our people to come here and deliver the message. And they get up on Wednesday night, and they take the key and they go open up the meeting place and they fire up the coffee pot and they wait for Ralph White to show up. They go in our jails and they go in our institutions and they look for me. And they work and they get on committees and they argue with each other and they show up here early and they open the doors and they say something like, no man is going to be turned away. And they look for Ralph White, the shadow soldiers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so grateful that it's men sitting in here that took that responsibility whenever anybody anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of A to be there, and for that I'm responsible. That took the responsibility seriously. That personalized the responsibility. That took up the challenge. That waited on a guy like me. That still waits on a guy like me. See, a guy like me, by nature, you know, I'm not who you think I am. What I am is pretty much a perpetrator. You know, I'm all front and no back. I'm all about style over substance. You know, what I really am is an image conscious guy that wants you to like me. I'm really not interested in telling the truth. I'm just interested in what I can convince you of. That's the kind of guy I am by nature. And when I listen and when I hear about people coming here year after year after year, you know, my inclination is to come up here and dazzle you with my knowledge of the book. I want you guys to be impressed with what it is. I probably want to quote some page line references. You know, I want to do something like that. But I remember what it was to be new to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They asked for the people to stand up who are scholarship. And I don't know if everybody's new, but I'm glad we had a cabin meeting, because I know for a fact there's some new guys sitting up in here. And I don't mean just new to the rock. You know, Bill asked for those people to stand up. But I'm talking about the most important people sitting in this room tonight. We got some new friends sitting up in here. And I remember what it was like to be new to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember a guy standing up in front of the group somewhat like I am tonight, dressed pretty nice, hair comb, eyes bright, stringing sentences together real well. And I remember thinking to myself, I know that cat ain't been where I've been. I know he ain't felt what I felt. I know he ain't done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? So it's real important that I let you know that the man that's standing in front of you tonight is not the same one that stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous some few summers ago. I'm going to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today, in the hopes that one of the guys sitting out here tonight, like I was sitting out there some years ago, thinking to himself, might be thinking, man, I used to do the same thing. I used to feel the same way. Or more important, I too want to have this thing. Quick bio, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I'm one of six boys. We stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room. Six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. Earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be like him. My father wasn't abusive and my father wasn't violent. My father was an absentee drunk. Every other Friday, like clockwork, you knew he wouldn't be at home with a check. It would be a kid in the neighborhood who would feel like it was his duty to inform my family how my old man had been performing up at the pool hall the previous Friday or Saturday night. And I would be ashamed and I would be embarrassed. And those are feelings I'm familiar with from an early age. Pops got put out when I was 9 or 10 years old. Moms proceeded to raise six boys by herself. Now, my mother was a... You know, and in my story, I'll do a lot of sharing about my mom. And my story is one that includes some achievement and some accomplishment. And I've had the opportunity to do some things and accomplish some things. And all the stuff I've ever done, none of it was through any virtue of mine. It was because I was scared of my mama. My mama was, you know... My mama was an old Southern Baptist sister, and she didn't play. She had these six boys that she marched up to church every Sunday morning. I hated it. I'd see cats playing football on Sunday morning, and I'd be thinking to myself, man, I got a square mom. These cats' mama is cool. Why? And I said to myself, when I turn 16 years old, you won't have to worry about Ralph White darkening the doors of anybody's church again. I meant it, and I did it for a very long time. But I had this old Southern Baptist mom that raised these six boys by herself. Now, my mother was a welfare mom. She didn't have no money, and she was on welfare. She didn't have a high school education. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you're grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old and you're coming home from school on a Wednesday afternoon with a couple of partners and you hit the front door and mom's is in the living room with a rag on her head and the ironing board up, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed. And you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in that prison I've lived in much of my life. Prison I live in sometimes even today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to shape and mold and form your opinion of Ralph. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. Probably need to clear something up right here because somebody is getting the wrong idea about what we got happening. Somebody's out there probably thinking to themselves, this guy might be all right speaking. He's looking around the room making eye contact with everybody. Don't let that fool you. I'm looking for the person whose attention is drifting, look like you're going to sleep. I'm going to work on you. You'll like me before this is over with, right? Trapped in what I think you think about me. And to our new friends, you know, you hear a lot of common themes in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the common themes you'll hear from a lot of our members is they never felt like they fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. Now, you would hear, you would think from my story, poor kid, part of Watts, grew up in poverty. Oh, man, he got a lot of reasons to drink. No, I wouldn't have changed the way I grew up for nothing in the world. I love the way I grew up. Love my neighborhood. Love the time I came up in. I came up in the 60s. It was a changing time. It was a turbulent time. And I was caught up in it, you know, and I was going to be somebody. I was not going to be my daddy. Yeah, I had five brothers, but we never, you know, for me, what that meant was I never knew a lonely moment. Baseball was my game. We made up the whole infield. One of my brothers played left field. I'm the kind of kid that went to sleep on Christmas Eve in all his clothes because I couldn't wait for Christmas Day. Mind you, my mother was a welfare mom with $50 maybe for Christmas, a $50 budget for these six boys, and we would get board games and checkers and dominoes. I might get a glove or something. But I didn't know what I didn't have. Sometimes you don't know till you grown and start providing yourself. It was a lot of love in my house. And people would come over and moms would cook and we'd have a family over. And man, I'd be excited on holidays. And I couldn't imagine being anybody but myself. You know, it's a trip being in the same family. I got a brother that does this deal too. And he goes out and talks a lot. And sometimes when I listen to him, I'm like, were we in the same house? Because his perceptions are, you know, are a little different. But man, I wouldn't have changed it for nothing in the world. I would not have changed it, you know. Things were changing. It was a changing time. It was an exciting time in this country. And I am going to be somebody, you know. So I'm growing up, and I'm not going to be my daddy. I am not going to be my daddy. So I'm growing up, and I'm doing some things, you know. And, you know, and so, you know, my story is not one. I'm not alcoholic because I come from a broken home. Somebody in here right now, sitting in here, that grew up with both parents in the house. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm a poor kid from South Central. Everybody, I don't think nobody else in here right now is from South Central Los Angeles. I'm not an alcoholic because I grew up and we didn't have no money. Somebody in here grew up with a silver spoon. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm a short guy. There's a whole lot of big guys in here. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm a black guy. There's a whole lot of white guys in here. I'm an alcoholic for two reasons and two reasons only. When I start, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. Two, when I sincerely don't want to start again, I start again anyway. I'm bodily and mentally different. That's it. That's all. The rest is my story. My story goes a little bit like this. Every one of you had me in your classroom. I was usually class president, student body president. I was a straight A student. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, it seemed like I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really know me, you won't like me. Yeah, I'm teacher's pet. Yeah, I was straight A student. Would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. If I just could have been cool, because I'm telling you, it was a whole lot more currency placed on cool than smart in South Central Los Angeles, you know. Some of you guys, because the cats who was cool, some of you in here right now, I see you. In the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters with them. You know, and you knew how to talk to girls. And girls were a mystery to Ralph. Later on in life, man, I'm the kind of cat, you know, it seemed like, and I don't know if it happened for nobody else in here, it seemed to me like all the rest of you guys had an answer on this manhood thing, and you just wasn't letting me in on it. It seemed like y'all just knew what it was to be a man, you know, and just was withholding the information from me. We'd be standing on the corner, 13, 14, cats would be talking about throwing down with girls already, right? I didn't know you were lying because I was doing too, but I was like, man, I was like, how do they know this kind of stuff? Later on in life, you know. Later on, when you start getting out and doing things on your own, I'd be partying. And in my crew, it would always be a couple of cats who were players, right? And I could remember one of my boys would be in the club, and he'd have baby in the corner. And he'd say something to her, and she'd giggle. And I'd be ear hustling because I want to know what to say to a girl to make her giggle. Ralph didn't have that any, man. But that's, and I always felt like the rest of you guys had this secret to this man thing that I just didn't have, right? So I'm growing up and I'm shy and I'm introverted. I'm 16 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's old to not have done anything. You know what? This is the first place I've came because my home group is a group in South Central Los Angeles and it's got some hard recovery there. And I used to love the stories. Alcoholics Anonymous is the first place I came where folk try to out-bottom each other, right? I never... I wanted a penitentiary story, but I sure didn't want to go to the pen. You know, but I like them exciting stories, you know, hard, but yeah, you know, but, you know, so my story in Alcoholics Anonymous is I started late. You know, even though my father was alcoholic, I experienced the effects of alcoholism, absentee dad, but I never saw it. And I never knew I did. Pops drank away from home. He left us pretty early in life. And moms never drank. I didn't see alcohol in my house. Some Saturday mornings I could remember moms going up under the bed and she'd be sweeping and the Ripple bottles would clink together. She put them in a big brown bag and took them outside to the big trash can. But that's the closest I got. So I I'm kind of slow in relative to a lot of other people. I wasn't doing nothing. I'm 16 years old. Still ain't touched nothing. I'm not going to be my daddy. Fast track success. At 16, I get a girlfriend. Now, Ralph with a girlfriend don't mean the same thing it means for some of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes that went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a suitable amount of time to pass, told my other boy, look, I want to go with her. He went and asked her, came back and told me, she said, yes, now I got a girlfriend. Right? Ralph don't do girls. You know. Check this out. You know, I'd had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend. Right now. Check this out. Remember them old rotary phones? There's a lot of cats. Remember them old rotary phones? This is my official girlfriend. If you ask her who you go with, she would have said, I go with Ralph. Then my official girlfriend, I call her on the phone back in them days. That seventh number would go around and seem like it would come back in slow motion and terror would set in. Because I knew what would have to happen when she answered. It's the phone. I got to talk. No conversation from my girl. I just hang up on her. Click. You know, this particular night, I went out on a double date. Me and my girl in the back seat, older partner of mine and his girl in the front seat. Plastic cup of rum and coke comes to the back seat this particular night. Drank that rum and coke down. It went down real warm. Rushed back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said. I'd arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be and say without it, and I liked it. I liked it a lot. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about me in lots of places, and it starts in the front in the doctor's opinion. There's a line in the doctor's opinion that jumped out at me the first time I read it. Men and women like Ralph drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Recognized it the first time I saw it. I'm not one of them people. I remember because this older cat would go to parties and he'd take me to places when him and them old veterans would be up in there drinking that scotch. And you guys know how you are and be like, ah. I'd be like, ugh, but I like what it did when it went down. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand we talk about this disease being progressive in nature because that's how it showed up in me. That first night I drank, I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over myself. I got a warm, tipsy feeling. I kissed and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before. You know, and I was cool. That's how drinking stayed for me. And that's how my drinking stayed for a time. I would drink to go out and party. I graduated from high school in 71, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I'm still drinking to go to parties. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only to go to parties, but in the daytime on the weekend to get ready for the party. By 72, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but I'm drinking after class during the week. By the end of 72, I'm drinking and I'm smoking herb, and I'm selling herb. By 1973, I'm drinking, smoking herb, selling herb. I'm doing other drugs. I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way I was living. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false, and the way that worked for me was this. In the way I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young? With a bright future, with a little bit of money. I was getting financial aid. Didn't chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over to my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? You know, I came up in a time and in a place and in an era. You know, I got utmost respect for a lot of you guys. It's cats to come up to the podium, man, and come up here and be sharing with precision what happened when I took that first one. It eased this knot and it filled this hole and it took away this pain and, you know, and I escaped from the, and, I did a lot. And I didn't. And if you came up at the time I came up, rolling with the people I'm, that's just what you do. It's just what you do. You know, I'm at this major university. I'm rolling with people who would later on be, you know, captains of industry, professional athletes, political leaders, business leaders in my town and in this country. And I'm going to be one of them. I'm going to be one of them. You know, I came around this program. Somebody bring me back if I get diverted. I'm going to go on the path for a minute. I came in this program four times before I came to stay. And I could never find myself in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous any of the previous times I came around here. I did that dangerous thing. It's a few things, thin lines in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thin lines. And I did that thin line thing and I fell on the wrong side of the thin line. When I would listen to you guys and when I would read the Big Book, I would compare rather than identify. You know, and I always came up short. I couldn't find myself in any of the stories. I would read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd read Bill's story. And Bill's story, Bill was an older white guy. No, we ain't got that in common. You know, Bill was a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam-era draft dodger. You know, Bill and his story talked about there had been no real infidelity. He missed me on that one, too. You know, Bill, you know, he was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. So I could just not find myself in any. I couldn't find myself in the Big Book. Couldn't find myself in the story. Couldn't find myself in any of you guys sharing. And when I came back this last time, somebody taught me how to read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way that you listen to our members share their stories when they get to the podium. When you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, when you listen to our members share their story, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read Bill's story in light of those questions, I found Ralph's story. Because Bill in his story, he talked about the drive for success was on. I was part of life at last. And I'm at this major university. And I'm rolling with these people. And the drive for success was on. I was part of life at last. And he said something else. Because I'm not going to be my daddy. He said, I'd prove to the world I was important. My goal when I was a kid, and I meant it with everything in me, I said, I'm going to be the first black president in the United States. And people used to pat me on the head and say, you go for it, because I was an accomplisher. And I was used to doing things, and I was used to getting praise and getting rewarded. And people used to push and motivate me. And Bill, in his story, talked about he imagined himself the head of vast enterprises. And I identified with that kind of grandiosity. I'm going to be the first president, you know. So I found myself. You know, I found myself in a story because that was me. I'm at this school, man, and I'm rolling. And it's just some people in here know what I'm talking about. I don't mean any disrespect to our young friends, but, you know, I don't mean new friends, young friends. I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. I'm glad I came up at the time I came up in. You know, I came up in an era when you go to a concert, you don't even have to know your neighbor. You just passing it. You know what I'm saying? I came up in that era. I came up at the time, you know, when it wasn't. And even though it was a turbulent time and it was a changing time, in some ways it seemed like a simpler time. In 2009, you got to worry about sexually transmitted diseases, practicing safe sex. You got to worry about AIDS. In those days, man, I'd go to a club. I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. I don't need to know your sign. I don't need to know your mama's name. I don't need to know your last name. Let's get to the basics of this relationship. Do you do it the way that I do it? And that's the way it was, man. Bill in his story talks about from this alloy of drink and speculation, from this combination of his drinking and his thinking, he forged this weapon that will later turn the ribbons and turn on him like a boomerang and cut him the ribbons. Bill talked real flowery. My grandmother had a shortcut way of saying that. She used to say, trouble always start out like fun, and that's how it was for me, man. You know, trouble always start out like, because you couldn't have told me. You couldn't have told me, man. I'm rolling with a fast crew. The people I'm rolling with, you know, wasn't nothing negative happening yet. I'm not seeing negative consequences, man. And that's just the way, and I'm who I wanted to be. I'm a part of life at last. And just like Bill, drink has taken a more important and exhilarating part in my life. And so I'm rolling, man. So I get through this school, and I get out of school, and I start working, and I start working as a counselor for L.A. City Schools. And even so, I should have had the kind of job that allowed me to acquire what normal people did. I never did that. You know, I'm the kind of cat. You know, a couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from. One of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the stuff that's crystal clear to me now, looking back on the rearview mirror of experience, was not at all clear to me then when I was going through it. I had a good job. And one fact stands out real clear to me about the days when I thought alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it. That's all. And I can't tell you the day or the time or the hour. I can't tell you where I was or what I was doing when alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me and became a necessity. I can tell you that it did happen for me. I'm one of them cats that play the regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know the one, I sit around and I look at people like Chuck and be like, if I ever get like that, I quit. You know, I look over here. Man, you ought to quit, you know. And I'm like, anybody else play the regret game? And the regret game in AA goes something like, if I only knew then what I know now, I never would have took that. Yeah, right. Kind of reminds me of a story I like to tell about a boy named Johnny. Johnny had a habit his father frowned on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. You know, father comes home early one day. Little Johnny's bedroom door is closed. Father opens the door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father looks at him and says, son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind. And little Johnny stopped and looked up at him and said, well, daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses? You know, and that story reminded me of me and the life. Because I see you going down, you going down, I'm just going to do it till I need glasses. And we don't have enough time for me to say, you know, the book talks about seeking the Lord companion, and we don't have enough time for me to share all the things with you to let me know I was becoming the Lord companion. I got married on a Saturday afternoon in April of 1980. I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the rest of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. But all of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor party till 7:30 in the morning. Me and my brothers, right? Four of us eventually made it to the program. They take me home at 7:30. They pour me in the bed for my 1 o'clock wedding. I get up at 10 o'clock. I'm toe up. I just laid on the bed. You know one of them nights, you know, where you just throwing up stomach line and then ain't even nothing left. You just, you know, I'm supposed to say my own vows at the wedding. And so I stumble and stagger in there. My then wife-to-be is looking at me staggering, and she look at the preacher. She says, scratch the own lines. Say the regular on his ass, right? So now my lines are cut to two words. So it gets to me in the ceremony. I get ready to say, I threw up. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. To our new friends, be anything like me, when I first hit the rooms, although I was familiar with most of the words you guys use in here, the way you guys use them is not the way I use them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. You were talking about a psychic change and this phenomenon of craving and this allergy of the body. And I needed some help with that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal. And I lived it over and over and over again. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch. My wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up. Going to the dining room table, picking her purse up off the table, clutching it real close to her as she went back to the bathroom. And I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home, sticking my key in the door. Wife and 2-year-old daughter sitting over there and they crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a husband? Do I have what it takes to be a father? Because you, if you're in the life, your track record already gives you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you the one bringing the wolf to the door. I came up in my house several times. Several times I pretended to call LAPD. Several times I knew I was playing a game with myself because they had told me, you're going to give us our money or we're going to come up in there and get it. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch. 2-year-old daughter coming outside pulling at my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't ready to be stealing from my daughter, and I wasn't ready to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. I've shared with you guys that my disease is progressive in nature. And in my experience, it's progressive in a couple of areas. Share one already. It takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily than I used to be willing to do to chase it. First time I went in my wife's purse, if you had strapped me to a poly, I would have passed when I said I'm not stealing this money. I'm going to take this $40 and I'm going to replace it before she knows it's missing. And I meant it with everything in me because I don't steal. You know how the line keep moving when you're in the light? First, you don't steal. Then I don't steal from nobody I know. Then I don't steal from my family. Then I don't steal from my wife. Ooh, I know I wouldn't steal from my... It keep moving, but I don't steal. And I took this $40. I deliberated a while before I hit the purse that night. And she had more money in there, but I just took $40 out. And I said, I'm going to replace this $40 before she knows it's missing. And I went and I spent that $40 up that night and came back looking for some more money like I do. And she had moved a purse. And I didn't look that hard for it because I couldn't believe I had hit it anyway. And I said to myself, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. I like the fact that before I got up here, Bill played that clip. Because in 1934, the guy in that clip was in the hospital for the fourth time, Towns Hospital. And that December, something different happened to him. And he walked out of that hospital for the fourth time, and something different had happened. He had met with a partner of his, and this partner of his had told him some things, stressed to him the importance of working with somebody else. So 6 months pass, and this New York stockbroker goes out to handle some business out of town, and his business didn't come off too well. And he was in a hotel lobby, and he got thirsty. And he got thirsty. And in that hotel lobby, he could... that Mayflower ballroom, he could kind of look in and see the bar. And I imagine if he's anything like me, he could hear the ice in the glasses. Could almost taste it. I like gin gimlets. Turn out Bill Wilson, when he was nursing that gin, he had gin and juice too when he was... his gin was going out last Ebby's preaching. So he's kind of like me. But he stood in that Mayflower ballroom, thirsty and not wanting to drink for the very first time. And he remembered what his boy told him. You need to work with somebody. And the way things look in hindsight, we can see the finger of God real clear. But when you're in the middle of doing his work, it don't feel like it. It just feel like I'm in big trouble. And he's standing in that lobby. He sees a directory and he starts frantically calling numbers. Series of divine coincidences. He come across a preacher who put him in touch with a lady. And the lady was prayer partners with this lady who had a husband. And Henrietta Seiberling told Bill Wilson, I got a number for you. And so they called Ann Smith. And Bob Smith had been on a bad one. and he was in the doghouse. So just like I would do to get his old lady off him, he said, "Yeah, let this guy come over tomorrow and talk to me. I'll give him 15 minutes." Bill Wilson went over to see Dr. Bob Smith. And that 15-minute talk turned into about 4 hours. And those two gentlemen discovered something. And in a couple of years' time, 40 drunks were sober. Imagine that. And they said to each other, "We might have stumbled up onto something, man. We might have found something. How are we going to let Ralph White know when it's his turn?" They said, "We'll write a book." And they put me in that book. They put me in that book. Because 2 weeks after I hit that purse and made that vow that I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing, the same scenario presented itself. Been out spending my money, spent it all up, came back looking for some more money. And that idea of replacing the money, like I said I was going to do, they dropped a line that described me to a T. We don't know why, but the alcoholic could be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation, weeks, even days ago in my case. And that idea of replacing the money didn't even come to mind. It got replaced by another idea. I said, last time I took $40 out and came back looking for the purse to find some more money. This time I'll take all the money out the purse, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. And I didn't deliberate so long, and I was off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular basis. She started sleeping with it up under the pillow. It's not enough to stop somebody like me. You know why I go to meetings? Still, diligently, regularly. Because meetings is the only place I can go, and I just talk shorthand. You know, everywhere else you might have to explain something. I could say something in here like this. You know what it's like to be out doing what it is that we do and come home with that feeling on you and be laying in bed knowing that money's just an arm's length away? Somebody know what I'm talking about. And I'd be laying in that bed and that purse be up under the pillow, and I let that regular breathing set in, and I let it set in for a minute. And I come out my side of the bed and I crawl on her side, and I come out and I come up under the pillow and I come out real slow. I creep out the bedroom, jump, go in the living room, creep out the front door, jump in my car, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. It's Wednesday, I come back Monday. Did that one too many Wednesdays, came back one Monday. Screen door was locked, note on the screen, suitcase on the porch, the rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. I'm put out my house, I'm now my dad. And I went to stay over at my mom's house, and over the course of that next year, my five brothers got put out their respective homes, and we all ended up in my mother's house, and we damn near killed. And we damn near killed her. It's amazing how I found myself through all you guys' stories and throughout the big book, all the way throughout it, once I was able to see when I could see. Because Bill had went to live with his in-laws. And he said, little was anybody to know he wouldn't draw a sober breath for 5 years. And in that period of time, he talked about Lois coming home from work, carrying a bag from the department store. And my mother came home every single day with a bag of groceries, because if she kept any food in the refrigerator, these 6 grown leeches that she gave birth to would have cleaned the refrigerator out, because that was our little hustle every day. And we damn near killed her. When I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. And she would bring my daughter over to my mother's house on Saturday afternoons so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand and my big hand, take her to the store and just buy her some ice cream. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read a story to her. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get. The look like, this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like, I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I would disappear. It would be Saturday afternoon. I'd sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was coming to pick her up. Could still see some of them long Sunday nights, man, them two heads sitting in the car and the headlights backing out the driveway. And I'd be peeking around the side of my mom's house, tears flowing. And I'd be thinking to myself through the tears, there goes my life backing out this driveway. I've heard a lot of members share about being scared of dying out there. That's not a part of my story. I was never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas. Over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October the 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough and I got tired enough that I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. 2 days later, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that October in 1986, I got to let you guys know I was in a real bad way. And when we share our stories in a general way, we just give a quick sketch. We give a quick outline. See, what I didn't let you guys know was I was what the book really describes as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It says the alcoholic, more than most people, leads a double life. Because I was succeeding in my work. I was working in management in the law department of a major utility company. I used to have this office, and the office had a big glass window. Supposedly, the big glass window allowed me to look out on the workforce. Unfortunately, it allowed the workforce to look in on me. And when you be off one of them 4 or 5 day runs and you get that whiplash going and look to see if anybody see you and everybody sees you, you know it's a cold thing when the double life starts merging into each other. When you start going to work in the same suit you was in 2 or 3 days ago and you think if you take a tie off, nobody will notice, you know, and it's greasy and you smelling and that's the guy I'm in. And I got let go from that job, and at the end of my drinking and using, I hadn't worked in a long time, and I was real. And guys like me don't get second chances. That October in 1986, I was tore up. I was full of remorse and I was full of regret, and I was full I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done and the things I had become. Speaker was standing up in front of the group, and he was sharing about taking from the job, and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And that speaker that night caught my attention. And he went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope at the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to. He described to me what I suffered from, and he did it in a strange way. I had never seen anything like it. A lot of people had been talking at me, a lot of people had been talking to me, and a lot of people had been talking about me. But this cat was talking to me, talking about himself. Had never seen anything like it. Seemed like I was taking everything he said personal. He shared that it was something physically different about him. And seemed like he invited me to diagnose myself. Ralph, don't take my word for it. Ask yourself, how many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20. What happened? whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop off here at happy hour for a minute? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to stop over here at my boy's house for a minute? What? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, from 1979 to 1985, whole paycheck. My experience, not yours, not my sponsors, not Bill Wilson's, not Dr. Bob, not nobody else's. My experience abundantly confirms for me when I take one of anything, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay, smart guy, how do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday. Second part of this disease, the mental obsession, the obsession that somehow, someday, I will be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered. And where the hell is that coming from? Somebody help me. Control and enjoy. Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. Anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I stuck on that? Why am I stuck on that? I can't drink because of my body. I can't not because my mind refuses to accept that fact I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 describes it as a soul sickness. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical are straightened out. That's what we do in these rooms. Don't get scared. Somebody in here is like me and say, oh, you're getting ready to slip the G word on me. Don't trip. You know, I come from that dark place. You know, I'm not the speaker tonight because I came up in here out of virtue. Somebody in here is probably thinking, yeah, you're going to stand up here and tell me about how good God has been in your life. You're going to tell me about all the things he's done. But that's easy for you. You like it. Check this out. None of us up in here right now that's been doing this deal, ain't none of us came up in here walking toward the light. I came up in here running from the fire. And if your ass is on fire, you know. You know, I hear people all the time talking about it take courage to come back in. And I'm not knocking that for any of the people that came back in these rooms. You know, I'm not. But for me, because I came back four times, it really didn't take courage. It took desperation. And I pray you desperation. I pray you desperation. See, because I came up in here four times. And the other three times, I was serious about recovery each time I came. And each time I came, I was loaded. And the last time, I added a different element. This time I was committed. Serious is how I feel. Committed is what I do. I was committed to do whatever it took to stay sober one day at a time. I learned some anatomical facts about a guy named Ralph. I learned that when my behind is raw, my mouth closes and my ears open. It's just that when that behind starts healing, mouth starts opening, ears start closing. This time it was tenderized enough, long enough that I was able to hear something. And I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's trying to scare you into staying sober. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's going to tell you if you go out there, it's still kicking. I'm not, that ain't my message. If you go back, no. I told you guys, and if you read between the lines, you can probably tell. Told you in my heyday, I did some of everything, you know. People used to look at me then and be like, man, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdose? And I'd be like, scared of overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more. So the message of the whole alcoholic of my variety is not the message of fear. The book talks about a message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. And the message tonight's speaker brings to you that's got the most depth and the most weight is you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not know what school his little girl was enrolled in and did not know where his family was living. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake-up call to go to work in so long, I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy who graduated from a major university in this country, and my job at the end was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage, and I was eating lemons off the neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And I stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in that condition. And the men and women in this fellowship loved me and nursed me back to health. Gave me a way out upon which we all agree. Said something to me that I found real strange at that time and I didn't believe it. They said, let us love you till you can love yourself. That one I didn't believe. How you going to tell me you'll love something like me? You turn your back on me, I'm liable to go in your purse right now. I stink. You going to tell me you'll love something like me? And that was before I knew what takes place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was before I knew what happens when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we specialize in loving unlovable people. and you loved me and you nursed me back to health. Gave me a way out. I come from a dark place. I come from a real dark place. See, I come from a place that on Friday night, you don't have to ask. You'll find me walking. You'll find me walking the street with nowhere to go at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. That's how I do it. And it got like that for me. And it didn't start like that for me. I had a family. I had a bright future. I'd built up a bright future. I was the first kid off my block to go to college, and my brothers that followed me, we were the first three. Everybody knew the white boys. Some years later, everybody knew them again because Neighborhood Watch was get their asses off this street. And I came into the rooms, man. And I found out what this program is really about. If you're sitting in here and you think this program is just about not drinking and just about not using, you're shortchanging the program and you're shortchanging yourself. I'm not knocking physical sobriety. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it home with a whole paycheck. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might stop going to jail on Friday night. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it to work on Monday morning. But what this program has to offer is a whole lot more than that. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that can do anything but fail. This program is really about, with a face on it. See, the program Alcoholics Anonymous is not 164 pages in a blue book. Program of recovery is outlined in that blue book. God ain't contained by the pages of a book. Program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not some steps on a wall. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it walks and it talks and it shakes hands. It's got a beating heart. It's got arms that hold and that hug. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you want to see Alcoholics Anonymous? You want to put a face on the program? What this program is about taking people like us, drunks and boosters and convicts and con artists, child abusers, wife abusers, failures as parents, failures as kids, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. And this program puts us together in one room, and I stick one hand in your hand and the other hand in God's hand. And we pick up our beds and we walk up out of these rooms as mothers and fathers and sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, employees, employers, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If it's going to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. I've had the opportunity to have so many remarkable things happen since I got my feet set on a path to really go somewhere. New friends, I'm telling you, you'd have a different speaker tonight if this was not the easier, softer way. I'm not the one that gets up here and tries to make it sound like, oh, this is hard, but it ain't no easy. Check this out. If it's supposed to be a program of attraction, make it attractive. Make it attractive, God damn it. I ask a guy with over, you know. You know, I say it all the time. I'm very serious about recovery, but I'm rarely serious in recovery. If you ain't laughing in this program, you ain't taking this program serious enough. You know, I had a guy that I was talking to. I asked this guy, you know, over 50-some years of recovery, what's the most important element you found over the years? And he's a thumper, and I thought he was going to go to this conscious contact with God or, you know, something. And he said enthusiasm. 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 You know, make it attractive. You know, and I'm one of the guys that got my feet set on a path to really go somewhere. And remarkable things started happening in my life, man. Remarkable things started happening in my life. Another woman found me worthy, and I got all the way down the aisle. I even got the I do out. I have pictures to prove it, you know. I got a 14-year-old daughter at home that's never seen her daddy loaded, and one day at a time, she never will. I dropped that girl off at my mom's house last night. And I'm staying here, and I'm leaving here on Tuesday morning, and I miscalculated my time because I got a boy that's here in recovery, and we're going to do some things and do a workshop. And my daughter leaves for Washington, D.C., in an eighth grade trip on Monday night. And you know, as I'm hugging her to leave, Because when she gets back, I'm going again, and I'm hugging her. And the thing about it, I go all over, you know, and I'm gone a lot. And I'll tell her I'll be home such and I've never seen the flicker of doubt in that little girl's eyes. Like, I wonder if daddy's going to be home. Because she don't know that other guy. That two-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in, she's 25 years old now. She's a second-year law student at the University of San Francisco Law School. I remember when she graduated from UCLA, we got a video, and you'll see me holding the two girls, and on one of the, you'll see them looking at me, and I get the look from my girls like, this is my daddy, and this is my hero. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. No. That wasn't my thank you that I was done, but you guys, I'm getting ready to be. It's just a couple of things I just gotta tell. I gotta share with you. I gotta share with you a couple of things. I got to, because you guys got me. I'm feeling it now, and I'm taking the challenge. I want to talk about that challenge before I get out from here. You know, my mother came out of her bedroom one day. Same house where me and my brothers damn near killed her. And I remember she was going to church. And her house was full of alcoholics. Full of alcoholics. And as she was walking out, tears in her eyes, she looked at these alcoholics. And she said, I want to thank you for my sons. Because we were sitting around our dining room table. And these 12 alcoholics had blue books open. And it was the very first meeting of what's later become the Never Too Early Big Book Workshop. And we started having a big book workshop at my mom's house. My mom was a church-going lady, and she couldn't wait for us to come back to church. And the second year we started having workshops, my mother sent us two deacons and a preacher from the church. And finally, you know, in this winter of my discontent, I want to share something with you guys, my challenge this weekend. Shed all them good things. In this last year, I talk about transparency. That's just what we do. Because in this last year, I went broke. I lost my house. In the midst of a divorce. Daughter's living with her godparents. And God will change you without your permission. I've been in three valleys in my recovery. I was one of them young Turks that used to say, it ain't the quantity of sobriety, it's the quality. Still believe that. But my hat is off to those of you who kept the light on for me, because I'm going to tell you something about sober experiences. I'm going to tell you something about 22 and a half years of sober experiences. I've been in valleys before, and I don't have to speculate. I know like I know that there's something waiting on me. I know like I know that you grow in the valley. I know like I know that you grow where you planted. I know like I know that God ain't saved me from that cesspool to let me drown in the bathtub. I know like I know that there's something that's in it for me. And I got the kind of sponsor that says, Ralph, is it all right now? Because it's been times I felt like quitting. It's been times I felt like, how can you be this stupid? You're 22 years sober and you lost everything. How can this happen to somebody like you? And I have to flip it. How can you not have seen a check since April the 9th of last year and you ain't been hungry yet? What kind of God is that? How can you not have seen a check since April of last year and you ain't slept outside one day? You have not missed going anywhere you want to go. You have not missed smiling. You have not missed laughing. And you know what? When I felt like I couldn't walk, Alcoholics Anonymous walked for me. When I felt like I couldn't go forward, Alcoholics Anonymous went forward for me. I'm going to tell you the benefit of working with somebody else, because I'm a material guy and I'm a money guy and I'm a what I can impress you with guy. And I still thought that, that was me. And God will change you before you know it. And you won't know that you changed till you need to know you changed. And these guys that have sat around a table with me, these guys that have sat up and listened and trusted me with fifth steps, these men and women who share with me in countless parking lots, those panels I've gone to countless numbers of times, those meetings I sat in when I wanted to get up, I never knew what was happening. I never knew God was doing something with me. Every year I get on my knees and I say, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Well, sometime when it's building time, it's going to be some deconstruction before it's reconstruction. And I just am convinced that he's doing some deconstructing and he got his hand on my life. He still got his hand on my life. And somebody in here is in a real dark place right now. Somebody in here is wondering, what is my challenge going to be? And I'm going to tell you, I know. He ain't never told Ralph White no yet. He gave me three answers. Yes, not now. I got something better for you. I just got my arms open. I got my arms open for my something better. You hear how people say that God won't give you more than you can handle? Yeah, well, I got to let you know something. Life will. That's why I need God. And boy, God is just... And in this long winter of mine, it keeps coming to me. They'll say, you know, this. Okay, God is going to go. He'll close one door to open another. Close, you know, but it's hell in the hallway. And I'm in the hallway. But here's the deal. If you end this thing, if you end it, I can't tell you what meeting I could have scrimped on. I can't tell you which commitment I could have let go of. Because I ain't thought about drinking. And my life is still good. And I'm still waiting on the best is yet to come. And I want to let you know, if you sitting out here and you living through your winter, you ain't by yourself. You in a new family. You'll never walk alone again. I don't care what it looked like to you. If you knew when you just entered this family, you just got yourself a new family. First name, your name, last name, alcoholic. We all in the same family, you know. And that's the thing. That's the benefit. That's what I've learned in this last year of mine. And that's the challenge, man. I'm standing on the third step. I still stand on the third step. Take away my difficulties. Why? So victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. You know, if my message is God can handle anything, guess what? Sometime I just got to have something for him to handle. I got a big one for him to handle. I'll be back to report to y'all when I'm on the other side. Not if, when I'm on the other side. Because he's been good to Ralph White. He's still blessing me right now. I'm still overpaid right now. I'm still in Atlanta, Georgia right now. I'm still laughing every day right now. I'm still standing on that third right now. Still standing on it. Because for a guy like me to get lifted from where I came, when that tape played, I thought about, what's Bill Wilson's and Bob Smith's greatest legacies? That they failed at life. And from that failure, look how many millions of people have been touched, man. He's transformational. Don't think you know the end of the story. Don't trip off what page you on. Don't even trip off the fact it looked dark right now. You know, you can't see around. I'm convinced. He's transformational. And he's just giving me another page in my story. You know, and I'm one of the ones, man, that'll stand up in front of you. You'll never hear Ralph White say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic.